Welcome to the Life Self-Mastery podcast, where we bring in entrepreneurs who have created online businesses and improved their lifestyles. Here's your host, Rohit Malhotra.
Hi everyone, this is Rohit from Life Self-Mastery, and today I'm excited to have Josh Muccio, who's a co-founder of The Pitch, a show which features entrepreneurs in need of venture capital funding. He's also a GP at The Pitch Fund, which is a generalist fund that invests at pre-seed and seed stage. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Rohit.
Awesome. So, you know, I had actually got to know about the show and the fund through Elizabeth Yin, who also, you know, was one of the guests on my podcast. And I'm quite intrigued about your journey. You know, you built and sold two startups, one in e-commerce and in media. But how did your journey start, and what got you interested in this world of media and venture capital?
Yeah, I had a very strange journey into entrepreneurship. But actually, I'm sure a lot of people would relate to this. It started in school. I had a professor, the dean of the School of Business, where I went to school at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he had us start a business for our senior paper. And so I came up with this like silly idea that I would repair phones. This is back in like 2010. The iPad had just been released, and I thought I would repair people's phones. And so I'd meet them at Panera or any coffee shop and try to repair stuff on the spot. So it's very like cottage, you know, kind of scrappy entrepreneur endeavor. We did it. We turned a profit, and like the goal of the business school was like, you got to turn a profit in 3 months. So it was like quite difficult. But that was like my first foray into it. And if I were honest, like why I chose to start the business is because the college professor told us that if we, started a business, our senior paper would be shorter. It would only be 25 pages. So it was like pure laziness, college laziness, that drove me to start a business. But that actually like little test I did, I bought a website during that time, and it was rumored that Apple was starting, you know, they were going to come out with a slate or a tablet device, and it was either going to be called iPad or the iSlate. And so I asked my fiance at the time, Lisa, now wife, like, which one do I buy? I don't know which one it's going to be. And she's like, you idiot. They cost like $10. Buy both. So we bought those domain names. And then it was announced that it would be called the iPad. And I put up a little WordPress site just to get some SEO juice, and then graduated from school and went and got a job in accounting. And I didn't touch that website for a year. But then a year later, I was about to get laid off from my job. It was in manufacturing, and I was like, you know, this like fresh out of school guy trying to run the books, and the company was going downhill. And so I saw the writing on the wall, and then logged into this WordPress site, and we had a ton of traffic on the website every single day. And I was like, oh, shoot, I guess I have a business here. So we flipped on, we put WooCommerce on the WordPress site, and then we had our first few iPads being shipped to us within the week. And of course, I'd never fixed an iPad before. So had to learn real quick, made a ton of mistakes in the beginning, but then ended up building that business. And we had basically a national presence where people were shipping us not only iPads, but, you know, phones and tablets and computers and all of that. And we rode that wave until the time when, this is about 2014, when they were shipping or like repair, you know, iFix phones, repair sites, basically on every street corner. And we were like, you know what, let's get out of this industry. It's getting really, really crowded. So found someone who appreciated our national online presence. And, you know, they bought our brand, and we moved on to podcasting. So that's kind of how I started.
Got it. And, you know, you built and sold e-commerce business and a media business. Which was easier to do? And, you know, what did you enjoy more?
The e-commerce business was easier.
Was it?
Well, I mean, because it was a physical product that like people needed, right? But media is different. Like finding something that people need, right? Because you think about like news, right? Like that's the most or maybe people think about Netflix, right? But like all of it, it's like really competitive and you're like competing for people's time and attention. So you really have to earn it. But yet it's just as expensive to acquire that customer. But because you basically have no budget to acquire them in the first place, because you're just charging, there's just an advertising basis on the other side, you don't have the funds to be able to justify some high user acquisition cost. So then you just have to use free methods, right? So this is why like people building newsletters rely so heavily on like viral growth loops or like hacks like that where they can grow their audience, or they do like promo swaps where you find another newsletter, another podcast, and you like trade audiences and basically, you know, tell your audience about this other thing. Hey, go subscribe to this other great show. That kind of thing. And so you just have tons of that stuff. Whereas if there was a ton of money flowing through the media company, you could invest and basically compete at the same level as an e-commerce business. So, but which one do I love more? I love building the media company so much more because people like I'm actually able to build relationships with people at scale. And I actually don't know the people I'm building relationships right now, but I suspect that from this conversation, I'll meet somebody down the line and they'll say, I first heard you on Rohit's podcast and like I binged your season and I loved it, right? And now they want to reach out and be part of our fund, or now they're starting a new business and they want to pitch on the show and then they pitch me, right? Like those are the kinds of things that when they end up working feel really special, and it's because it's relationship based. So that's why I love the podcast, even though the business model isn't as juicy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I love running the podcast. It's very so difficult to monetize it,
Yeah.
but want to understand, how difficult it is to raise funding for media companies. And do you think media companies can be venture backed and they can have a big outcome?
Sure, they can. I mean, but you can't pitch your typical VCs. You got to go to media, you know, funds that pitch, or sorry, funds that back media companies. And there are a few of them out there, not a ton, because not a lot of people understand media and how to build a really big brand. We haven't raised from media VCs because honestly, I think what we love so much is the relationship aspect. We raised a little bit from angels, but mostly people that like care about the show for some other reason and want to be involved. It's for them, it's not like they aren't expecting a $1 billion exit from our media company. But then it allows us to do other things like start a fund, which arguably is a much better way of extracting value or creating value from the thing that we're doing.
Got it. And how did the pitch start with your wife? Did you once you got an exit, that's when you decided to build a media company where you wanted others to pitch? How did the idea came across?
Yeah. You know, I would love to say I've got this real entrepreneurial mind where I think 10 steps ahead and I just plan the whole media empire. But unfortunately, that's not how my brain works. Like, I think I'm just one who likes trying stuff and likes, I'm definitely the like shoot, ready, aim kind of person where like I'll follow my gut instinct to do the thing. I think what I realized after that first exit is that like at least in America, like I can literally do anything besides like really hard sciences, like, you know, becoming a doctor or something like that, where I need years and years of schooling. For the most part, the world's my oyster. And so then if I can build anything, I realized from the first business, like I built value, but I didn't love the industry. I didn't love the customers I was working with. And so then when picking what we would do next, I just knew I wanted to love it. I wanted to build something where 10 years later, if I woke up and I was still working on the thing, I would still enjoy it. And so I dabbled in some consulting for a little bit. That wasn't the thing. I tried starting a couple businesses with my friends. I blame my friends. I think that maybe they weren't entrepreneurs. No, I'm just kidding. They were probably bad ideas. So those didn't go anywhere. One of them was like actually a WordPress hosting company. Highly competitive space. I don't know what we were thinking. And then I ran into Alex Bloomberg's podcast. I don't know if you ever listened to Startup.
No, Alex Bloomberg, is it? No.
Yeah, so this is the guy from NPR. He
Okay.
did Planet Money and then decided he wanted to start a venture-backed podcast company.
Oh, okay.
And he was actually able to raise a lot for a media company. I think they ended up raising 15 or 20 million, something like that, and built a whole suite of shows. But one of them was Startup that documented the journey of starting this company. And on his very first episode of this show, Alex Blumberg pitches Chris Sacca,
Oh, wow.
the guy, from Lowercase Capital.
Yeah.
And this story ended up getting turned into not a sitcom, but a TV show. I think it was called Alex Inc. It totally flopped, but the
Okay.
podcast version of this show is outstanding. It's called Startup, and I listened to the show when it came out in 2015, and it was I'd listened to a couple other business podcasts, and they were really, really tactical, but extremely boring.
Yeah.
I'm gonna totally throw shade here, but like Pat Flynn, his podcast,
Yeah.
very tactical. Sorry, Pat, very boring. He would get on and do these just long monologues about some thing that, was gonna help all of his listeners make money.
Yeah.
Anyway, I found it interesting and listened, but then I heard Startup and there was a narrative arc and this there were stakes and there was beautiful editing and sound design, and I was like, oh, a podcast can sound like this. This is
Me.
amazing. And then I heard the sponsors that they had on the show, and it was these big brands, and they weren't doing the whole, Athletic Greens, 20% off your order today by using coupon code the pitch. I don't actually, that code won't work. Don't do it. But like it was not the direct response. They were doing these big brand campaigns, and I thought, that's cool. I want to do that. And so then I'd actually already started the pitch at the time, but that was the moment where we started to pivot the idea. And in the beginning, it was just like a talk show, like me and you right now, and you would
Yeah.
pitch me your idea. And then we would do this thing where we would basically cut down your pitch, Rohit, and we would like send it to Dave McClure
Oh.
or Brad Feld or some other big name VC. And we would have them record a voice memo that they would send to us. And then we put their voice memo response about whether or not they were going to invest in the episode. Of course,
Oh.
they never invested because who invests off of a recording someone sends them? And
Yeah.
it's like there's no relationship there. There's not a
Yeah.
relationship to the founder, and there's not a relationship to me. I'm just a guy that like sent them an email and said, listen to my show. Anyway, that was the first version of the show, and it got
But
us
they
to.
respond back. But they all the VCs respond back.
Oh yeah, they would respond back. But our theory, which was completely wrong, was that VCs were too busy to do podcasts.
Yeah.
And we've since learned that like VCs not love nothing more than to appear on as many podcasts as possible.
Yeah, true.
So yeah, that's how it started.
Interesting. And two years later, you sold it to Gimlet,
Yeah.
and then it was then acquired by Spotify. But you also bought it back from Spotify. I think I'm more interested on why did you buy it back from Spotify? What was the reason?
Yeah. I mean, you can the story of what happened to Gimlet, whoops, inside of Spotify is well documented. There are Semaphore articles that talk about how Spotify struggled to make podcasting work.
Yeah.
And they have a few studios. I think The Ringer is doing pretty well, but most of the studios that Spotify bought have struggled. And I think a lot of it has to do with some politics inside of Spotify and the direction to take the shows that they had purchased. Of course, at the time, it was exhilarating to be a part of that acquisition and to join Gimlet Media. That story I was talking about, Alex Blumberg's podcast Startup, that was Gimlet Media. And so I eventually pitched our show to Alex, and we ended up joining Gimlet. And obviously we sold to them, but that was, because I mean, like speaking of relationships, that was because I'd listened to his show. He was the first person we pitched, right? So then buying the show back, this is fast forwarding 100 years, sorry, 100 years, no, 100 episodes of the show, 5 years about, because Gimlet show bought us in 2017. So 2022, we had just the pandemic had kind of messed with our show because you know, in the beginning, it was all just like remotely, but then what ended up becoming the catalyst for the show and what brought us to Gimlet and all this growth was we brought everybody together and we actually brought the investors in the room and became matchmakers for founders. And we got really good at it over the years. And, you know, I think we're at $11 or $12 million have been invested in the companies on our show. And it sounds maybe small, but at the pre-seed and seed stage, early levels, these are, you know, this is meaningful. And so, you know, we've been doing this for a really long time, but then because of COVID, we couldn't meet anymore. The studios at Spotify had shut down. And so then finally, you know, this was in 2022 when everything reopened again for the studios. That's when, you know, we started having conversations with them and just saying, hey, can we just buy the show? There's a lot going on inside of Spotify and, you know, Gimlet and yada yada. You know, like our show, as big as it is, it's small for a Spotify who's got like Joe Rogan, right? Like they're worried about Joe Rogan and making their money back on that deal. So there wasn't a lot, you know, it didn't make a lot of sense for our show to continue inside of Spotify. So we offered to buy the show back and they agreed. And here we are.
Got it. So super, super interesting. And how was the experience of pitching your own company on the pitch? What was something you thought?
You listened to episode 101. That was something I did not want to do. Everyone joked when we bought the show back. They were like, oh, you're raising money, you should pitch on your own show. And I was like, I know you think it sounds like a great idea, but it's not. I would say, have you heard the VCs on our show? They're ruthless. They're going to tear me apart. They don't want to invest in media. Turned out to be right. Actually, we did get a couple angel checks from these VCs, so that we appreciate we appreciated that. But I mean, pitching on our show, it was a last minute thing. One of the founders dropped out last minute, and then Lisa, this is, you know, my co-founder, she was like, and wife, she was like, we should do it, you should pitch on the show. And I was like, you're right, we need to. So we did. And on a just it was just a spur of the moment thing. We winged it. I pitched on the show, but I think luckily I'd coached so many founders on how to pitch before. And the blueprint that I coached them on was problem, introduce the problem. Well, introduce yourself first and then tell us the problem and a story about that problem. Why do you care about it? And then like one line about your solution and then like four lines on your traction, how much you're crushing it, and then the closer, which is, you know, how much money you're raising. And so I just applied that formula to our show and pitched it, and it turned out well. I actually started to cry during my pitch, which I didn't think I was a crier, but apparently I am. And I mean, it was nerve-wracking, but so much fun to pitch on the show. And the VCs, they're really like good at their jobs, but we've collected like some really thoughtful human beings over the years, and we've kind of gotten rid of the sharks that we've had a few sharks on the show, and we don't invite them back. And so we've got really thoughtful, like good VCs that will literally invest in anyone from anywhere and in any business model. There is some matchmaking on the back end, but like pitching that group was a real pleasure, but I'll never do it again. It's a one and done thing.
Got it. Interesting. And you know, 2023 was a difficult year for startup founders, but also for emerging, you know, fund managers. Well, what was the, you know, fundraising process for you?
People don't know this, but like there are a lot of funds that are closing up shop right now. And I suppose we'll hear about them in the coming years. It's kind of weird to close down a fund because you technically still have obligations for the previous funds that you raised and deployed, right? That's a 10-year journey from when you close that fund, if not longer, before a lot of these funds like actually, you know, realize their gains. And so you have all these fund managers that haven't been able to raise subsequent funds. And so they're closing down, but they'll be kind of like dead men walking, right, for a while. So yeah, it's a real bad time to be a VC, but I think in some ways it's also a great time to invest in companies. There are just so many great opportunities. So we launched our fund in the worst possible market to launch a fund, but our cheat code is we have this massive audience of entrepreneurs. And as it turns out, a ton of them are accredited investors that are now investors in our fund. Part of that episode 101, where we pitched the investors on our media company, we also mentioned, not in passing, we mentioned that we were starting a fund, but that's all we did was mention it on that podcast episode. And then after that episode aired, we had 1.7 million in interest within 7 days. And it took a while to actually close and onboard that, which, you know, there's some lessons learned there. But now we've got, I think we're halfway to our goal of $4.5 million fund one. Nice. But it's raised entirely from listeners, no institutions, no family offices. Well, except for the one family office who listens to our show. And I think we're going to just keep raising from our audience, and it allows us to stay really aligned. Actually, there was some concern from the investors that like starting a fund would become this conflict of interest and it might change the sensibility of the show, but it hasn't, because I've always, for the show, we've always been so focused on the founders themselves and like providing value for them and telling their story. And it's valuable for the VCs too, but like for us, the founders are the ones whose voices during the fundraising process aren't always listened to. And so now that we're investing in companies, we're still aligned with the founders. We're still looking to elevate great voices and great people building great companies and solving real problems. So in some ways, I think many ways, the show's only gotten better since we launched the fund. I don't know if there are any haters around who will say otherwise, but so far I haven't heard from them. People really, really love the fund and the podcast because it's a really cool experience. And listeners get to hear the host of this show that they love from all these years now investing in the companies that we bring on the show. And it actually feels really good and actually feels really organic. So anyway, of course, I'm very biased. So
yeah, no, absolutely. I read a tweet where you put it, all roads lead to VC or podcasting. So so I love that because, you know, I'm passionate about podcasting. I do a bit of angel investing, but but it's such a great story that, you know, you pitched on your show and you've been able to raise your entire fund from your listeners. And I think I met you before and I asked about the distribution process, because you get, you know, millions of downloads a month. What's the distribution process for newbie podcasters who would want to, you know, promote their podcast? Any advice for them?
Yeah, it's, in a lot of ways, it's harder to grow a podcast these days than it was, because everybody has a show. True. You know, in the beginning, you could just email Apple and be like, there was like one guy at Apple that ran the whole podcast. We used to call him the Mad King. Oh gosh, what was his name? And he's the king of podcasting because like he chose what shows got elevated, right? And once you made it on the front page of the podcast app, you know, you'd get, I think, something like 8 to 10,000 new listeners. And then, you know, it could just grow from there. Today, you kind of have to be everywhere. You kind of have to make your YouTube shorts. You've got to have the, you know, the blog version of your podcast, and, you know, and information travels so differently and on so many different mediums. And I think that's actually our struggle still to this day, is like reliably growing the show, when all I really want to do is just keep making an amazing podcast. I don't really want to do the 10 things that I need to be doing to grow the show. And so what ends up happening and what model has worked so far is, you know, joining a network like Gimlet Media, or in our case now, we're a part of Vox Media's podcast network. And, you know, we basically get to promote our stuff across their network of business shows. And then in return, we promote the network. And, you know, what better way to find out about a podcast than by listening to another podcast? So, you know, that's been our main way of growing up to this point, which is still hard because, you know, there are only so many networks. So I think there are some platforms, you may know of some, where you can like, you know, independent podcasters can kind of collude together and do promo swaps and things like that to promote each other's shows.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the relationship-based platforms like, you know, podcasting, SMS, and community-based platforms, and then there are discovery platforms like YouTube and Twitter. I think, well, you need to have a balance of, you know, having a relationship platform and then promoting it on the discovery platform. So I think you're absolutely right. It's becoming difficult, but you just need to be every day with TikTok and Instagram. I'm still learning the ropes on, you know, how do I distribute my content everywhere?
I'm not like a huge fan of those platforms and the short form content because I think that it just, you know, sometimes the best version of the thing is not the most viral. That's just the most viral version. That's just that one that makes the algorithm happy. But like, what's the best version of the story that's going to make the most impact on people? That's often different, right? And so having to optimize for what the algorithm wants. No, I want to optimize for my audience, my people. And maybe sometimes they're the same, but I find it slightly intolerable that I have to cater to some mysterious algorithm instead of just doing the thing that my audience knows, right? And so that's what I love about at least the show is I can be authentic and maybe it doesn't scale us to, you know, a billion listeners, but the people that listen really, really care and really, you know, value the thing that we're creating.
No, absolutely. And you know, the Pitch Fund focuses on pre-seed and seed startups. But have you seen seed ever been this competitive, especially in the last year or so?
So what's interesting is we don't get caught up in a lot of the competitive deals. And I agree. I mean, by the numbers, seed has gotten more competitive, especially with these later stage firms moving earlier and looking to make investments at seed. But because our show is so unique, we get a lot of deals that nobody else is really paying attention to. And you would think that that's adverse selection, but actually it's opportunity because oftentimes those deals are priced better. And so if I meet a great founder who maybe doesn't pattern match for all the things that all these other VCs care about, but they're actually building a great company and they're a great founder, we're going to make investments at a better price than everyone else who's fighting over the same deals. So maybe I can give you an example of this. We've got a company coming up in our upcoming season that's in EdTech. And, you know, VCs hate ed tech because the sales cycles are long. Well, this founder has an edge on ed tech because of her backstory and how much she cares about solving this problem for students. And you literally meet this founder, you're like, this founder is going to stop at nothing to solve this problem. They care about it. There's no way there's another founder that cares about this problem more. And that's the instinct you get when you hear her pitch. You know, even the fact that like this founder's a woman, like there's less capital available to her, but it's a damn good business. And so those are the types of opportunities we get to see, and we get deal flow from all over the country because of our show. So I think it's going to be an outstanding fund, but like, no, we don't compete on the same axis as every other VC fund. So I can't tell you if seed feels more competitive because on the deals I'm doing, you know, it's not.
Got it. Interesting. What advice would you give to founders, you know, who are trying to get brand names on the table, especially when it comes to pre-seed? Do you think such brand names are important, or do you think,
VC names? No. I mean, brand names matter, but I think at pre-seed and seed, there's so many different firms. Like, I mean, I would actually encourage founders not to have the big, you know, you don't want Sequoia's Scout investing in your seed round. You don't really want A16Z's Scout Fund investing in your round because then if they don't lead your next round, everybody's asking why, right? So you want to find a VC that like is actually going to get in the trenches with you And I mean, a lot of times, even at the seed stage, you don't need to give away board seats. Like a lot of people are giving away board seats because they don't think they have an option. You don't have to give away a board seat at the seed stage, right? Like keep hunting around, keep getting those offers, find someone who's gonna really partner with you, and then actually talk to the founders that they've worked with in the past, not just the ones they refer to you, but the founders that maybe whose companies went under, right? But they were backed by this VC. Talk to those guys, see how they talked about the VCs, because you find out someone's true character when things don't go well. And so, I mean, especially in this market, right? Like, don't go for the brand names. Like, find a partner at that VC fund. And like, I know people throw that term around, but like, really make sure that there's someone that you want to be in a relationship with over a long period of time. Because they're, in so many ways, they're going to be the ones that help you raise that next round and introduce you to your next VC. And, you know, or they might be the ones that lead it. So, it's good question though. I like that.
And you know, obviously the pitch has a great distribution network, millions of listeners, but how does, you know, other VCs help startups other than, you know, capital? What other ways have you seen them really add value to the startups?
I mean, introductions are the ways that VCs really seem to, you know, want to throw around things. A lot of times, like even introducing you to other portfolio companies can be super valuable. You know, I think so much of VC actually is trading information and trading tips on what's working right now for your marketplace business, for example, right? What are these 10 other companies that might be adjacent or they might be competitors? Like, what are they doing? What's the like tests that they're running, and maybe it'll work for your business, right? But to get that information, you actually need VCs who are investing across industries in all different business types, right? And you know, you have to ask specific questions to get those kinds of insights. But if you're the founder asking those questions, and it's not just like, hey, can you introduce me to this person, or can you introduce me to that? Although that's great too, right? Like founders do that all the time because that can get you some other strategic information. But really going in depth to be like, these are the things we're struggling with. These are the things that we're testing. Is there anything else we're not thinking about? Or what have you seen from other companies who are two steps down the line from me? What are the problems I need to be thinking about now? And just like, I think a lot of founders just don't communicate enough with their VCs. And they just talk about like top line, this, we grew this, and they're just like, we're crushing it. That's great, but I can't help you if you're crushing it. Right? Like, tell me how we can help. Like, that's the thing that you want to get out of your VCs. So I don't know if that quite answers your question, but it seems like the VCs that I've worked with in the past that provide the most value are the ones that will get in the trenches and like actually troubleshoot stuff with you. But don't wait till like you're like out of money to ask for help. Like, ask for help as you're deploying the cash, making the hires, and you know, considering what tactics to use as you grow the company, right? Like just be in just constant communication with your VCs. You know, the good ones will really appreciate that.
Got it. And Josh, with the new fund, how do you look at portfolio construction, and you know, what is your required level of ownership, or do you, how do you look at it?
We kind of occupy this space in fund size that is just beautiful and pure. It's a micro fund. You know, when you're only raising $5 million, you really only, and at the cut check sizes we're cutting, you just need one company to really blow it out of the water. And then as long as the rest sell for something, you've got a you know, you're at least a 2x fund, right? Then if you get two that really outperform, you know, you very quickly can have a 4, 5, 6, you know, X fund. But you know, for us, like we only cut, you know, our check sizes are 50 to 100K, and the higher the valuation, the higher the check, it kind of scales up and down. And we just have to make sure at that valuation that if that exit, you know, let's say that company sells for $1 billion, it needs to return the entire fund. That math is really easy, right? at our current ownership level. So for the math for us, it ends up being right around 1% or a little bit less is our ownership at the pre-seed and seed. But it's great because we get to invest. As far as portfolio construction, it allows us to just, and it's not hard to get allocation when those check sizes are that small. And
Right.
because of our fund thesis is we get to co-invest with the VCs on our show. But because we're casting and becoming matchmakers for all these VCs, we can invest in any type of industry. We just have to be smart and put the right VCs in the room who are experts on that industry so that we can get the proper vetting. So it's almost like how most funds will invest in a founder and then introduce them to their next round of capital. But
Right.
we do it in reverse, in that we meet the founder, decide we want to work with them, introduce them to the VCs, and then if those VCs cut the check, then we
Just follow.
invest.
Okay.
So we get to kind of test them on the market, in this case VCs, to see which ones, pass the test, and then we invest.
Got it. And you're also a media founder. And when you speak to founders, what is it that they most want in the cap table? And do you see a generation of operator-led funds or founder-led funds going forward?
Yeah. I mean, so many of them are happening right now. And I think in some ways, those are great opportunities because they don't have the bloat that some of these really big VC funds who have hundreds of millions in capital and partners and junior partners and, all the different flavors of partners and, platform, like all of that. Those are all great things, but it's just, they're just very bloated and in some ways inefficient. Like, how do you provide all this value to founders at scale? Whereas some of these owner-operator led funds, you can really be specific about how you invest and only invest in companies where you yourself can provide that value for that founder. And you know when you're like in out of your element, right? And you shouldn't be investing in a deal. So do I think we're going to see more of that? Absolutely. But also just because like those funds are easier, I would think easier to raise because clearly this person has a track record of building companies. They should be able to recognize themselves, pattern match for themselves in future businesses. And then it's clear how they can provide value, right? And a lot of those, funds, like they have some of them, they don't even charge a carry, right? Or they don't even charge a management fee because the founder's like, well, I'm going to be making these angel investments anyway. Do you want access to my deal flow so I can cut bigger checks? And so some of the economics on those funds are really, really great. And in this market where every LP is kind of critiquing the cost structure of their VC investments, I
Yeah.
think those opportunities tend to stand out. The risk is that if you invest in one and their like real thesis or expertise turns out to not be in favor with the overall market, their investment is in e-commerce brands, their specialty is e-commerce, and then e-commerce is in the dumps, right? Then that's gonna not be great for your fund.
Yeah.
So I'm sure if you're doing that, you should probably cut small checks and invest in a lot of specialty owner operator run funds then in that case. So which is a good pitch for a fund of funds that invests in owner operators. I
Yeah,
wonder if
yeah.
anyone's doing that.
I think a couple of them were doing in Europe. I just read about it and sifted. But yeah, I need to look into this deeper.
Yeah.
I think 2023 was the year of OpenAI and ChatGPT. I mean, they've done some great numbers, a lot of drama as well, but
Yeah.
$1 billion in revenue, I think that's great. But do you think you've seen a lot of AI pitches in the last couple of months, or do you think this year almost, there's another view from VCs, like 95% of all AI companies will go to zero? Or well, what is your opinion about AI? I think that is something which is quite interesting.
Yeah, I'm not that interested in general AI. And I might be using the term improperly because there are people certainly smarter than me in this. But I think where we look is for people building very specific use cases for AI, where someone really knows a customer. Okay, so I'll use this example. There's a founder on our upcoming season that's building AI tools for big e-commerce brands, right? Who do these huge photo shoots and bring in models for a new, clothing line that they're launching or a new makeup line. And these photo shoots for these big brands cost, $5-10 million, and they're big, and they end up doing, thousands of photos for this entire product line that they're launching, And this is a great case where if you could use AI and generate 10,000 images instead of 1,000, but they're more diverse, right? And there's so many more sizes, right? Like, this is because it's really hard at scale to do photos of all of the different types of and shapes of humans, right? And so they're using AI to help e-commerce brands scale their product imagery. They've got some early data that, like, it's really working. Cart abandonment is down, conversions are up, returns are down, like all of the metrics that really matter to e-commerce companies. But like, if you look under the hood, right, they're using Midjourney, applying some of their own kind of special models and ways of applying and like using Midjourney to generate these images. So there's something proprietary there, but then under the hood, right, like they're using Midjourney like a software developer would use AWS to, power their app. I think they're building something really interesting. It's going to be super competitive, but it's not a question of whether it's like going to go to zero. Like, they're building real value for real customers by applying AI in a really specific and interesting way. So that's, when I say like general AI, like I don't know what to invest in, like what might be the next Midjourney or the next ChatGPT. And I think I'd best not try to predict what that is. I should look more for those like really specific use cases where I know the pain is real for that customer. 'Cause then, then making it sticky on the back end is another conversation, right? And that I think is about like providing more than just a, ChatGPT or a Midjourney wrapper, but really having something proprietary and then creating either analytics or a SaaS platform that's combined with it that creates additional value. That's where I think it can get really sticky. So hopefully that helps answer the question.
It does. I mean, it needs to be seen this year, what's going to happen with AI and all those tools. But I quickly want to do the top three. What's your favorite business book?
Favorite business book.
Or a newsletter that you read?
Oh gosh, what's my favorite newsletter these days? Gosh, I forget the name of that newsletter I'm reading a lot of. It's apparently the branding on this newsletter is not that great. It's some like niche. Oh, it's like a Work Week. It's one of the newsletters from Work Week. The founder, Ryan Adam or Adam Ryan, something like that, writes this newsletter for media operators, and I find it really interesting as a, as a media founder. As far as books, there's like a negotiation book called Never Settle or Never something like that. Does that sound right?
I can't get the
Never
name, but I
Settle.
think,
Never Don't Split the Difference. I think
don't
that's what
split
it
it.
is. And I thought it was really fascinating. I don't agree with everything in the book because I think it assumes a zero sum mentality. And I think so much of negotiating is going in it with good faith. But because this FBI negotiator goes into so many circumstances where there's not good faith in the other side, and how do you negotiate with that person? How do you negotiate with the crazies? Of course, from my perspective, I'm just like, yeah, find someone else to negotiate with. Don't negotiate with crazies. But his model for actually negotiating with them is just wild. And it kind of made me understand the world differently. And it did help me in some negotiations to just like stand firm and stand my ground. So actually, I think a lot of the there's a lot of truth in the title, but the nuance of the book itself, it's not a lot of it's not particularly useful to me. Anyway, maybe I'm like selling myself on maybe not liking this book. I don't know. It made me think, and I like books that make me think, even if I don't agree with them. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think in schools and colleges, they should be taught about psychology and negotiation. And I think
Yeah.
these things are really important. But
yeah,
yeah,
how many
love
young
it.
people don't know how to negotiate because like they
Yeah.
just don't have that model, right? They haven't been
Yeah.
taught.
Yeah. True. And absolutely, we'll put that in the show notes. And what's your favorite online tool, for example, Gmail, Slack, Zoom?
Just have to be like workplace
No.
utility.
Yeah, no, it could be anything like fitness or anything that you use quite often.
I'm a huge fan of Podcast AI. So it's
Oh,
another
yeah.
AI company that's diving deep on the needs of podcasters and like applying, that, ChatGPT technology for our specific use case, which for me, being everywhere, as I mentioned earlier, as a podcast and like repurposing our content for all these different platforms is like such a chore. And so often I just don't put the resources into doing it because it's the last thing I think of after hitting publish. So to have a platform that like gets me 90% of the way and I just go in and kind of edit the chapters and edit the transcript and edit the shorts it generated, like to me, that's what I need in my life. So I just discovered this tool and I'm currently training it on all of the hosts' voices in our show so that
Oh.
eventually people can go to our website and chat with me and the VCs on our show and ask us
Nice.
questions. So I'm very
Wow.
hyped about that, but
Yeah.
that's a little bit down the road.
Yeah, no, I'll put that in the show notes and I'll definitely check it out later. And if I could go back in time when you started the pitch show, what is the one thing you would have focused on or done anything differently?
When I first started the pitch show, I was really focused on copying other people. I really wanted my show to sound like all the other shows I admired because I loved them. And then, but I was so focused on that and so distracted by what other people were doing that I missed the opportunity to build something really unique for us. And so for a long time, we kind of floundered, in running the show. We were still like a very big podcast. But I was kind of lost in my identity as the host of the show. And since buying the show back, I've really doubled down on the things that I care about and like finding out what is unique about our show and what our listeners like, as opposed to what do other listeners like. I don't care what other listeners like. I only care about what my listeners like. And it's small stuff, right? Like what you cut in an episode or what you title, the shows. Like it's little stuff like that, but it really matters. And it's like once you've dialed, I don't know, people talk a lot about product market fit, right? And I don't know if this is what it feels like being a founder, but like so much has come from starting the fund and doing all these other things as a part of the show, as opposed to just focusing on like being a podcast that just sells ads and scaling that, right? Like to me, it's about all of the other things that we're doing, as well as the podcast. That's just really, it's all like we just threw this event in Miami. And I'm
Right.
telling you, I'm my energy level right now on this call is probably so different from when we chatted a month ago. And it's
Nice.
because I spent time with the community of people that have been listening to our show at
Nice.
an event where we were recording the next season of our show. And it was so just life-giving to me to be with those people. And like we have this incredible community and I'm just now meeting them. Just now, 7 years. But it took starting the fund and doing all this other stuff to open up this opportunity. So really long way of saying, like, figure out your own thing. Stop paying attention to what everybody else is doing. Focus on your people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Love the lesson. Focus on your thing and focus on your listeners. And Josh, I want to know what's the best way people can reach out to you and know more about the pitch fund and the pitch show.
You should start maybe with episode 101 of The Pitch. See if you like me and Lisa's story. And then if you do, skip to the new episodes. Don't go back to the old stuff. We were learning back then. We're still learning now, but we've come a long way. So you can search for The Pitch on any podcast player. We're everywhere. But then also if somebody just wants to reach out to me, I'm josh@thepitch.show. That's my email. I love talking to people over email. I used to do Twitter, but then Twitter became not fun. So telling you. I don't know about you, but my Twitter is just like a bunch of spam notifications, like all these people minting things. I'm just like, when did NFT Twitter take over? It was after Elon. I mean, I don't hate Elon, but I am not enjoying Twitter. X,
Yeah, I
whatever
mean,
they call it.
yeah, X Twitter is so different. My engagement has really fallen down. I don't know. I'm back
Everyone's
to,
has.
yeah.
I'm talking to like the VCs on our show that have huge Twitter followings, and you look at their tweets and you're like, man, they are crushing it. Why do my tweets suck? They're feeling the same thing. They're like, our reach is so much lower. It's because just the people aren't like, I know they say the engagement numbers are up. I think Elon's lying. Like, they're not up. People are not on Twitter anymore. Anyway, anecdotal, email me.
Awesome. We'll put that in the show notes. Josh, thank you so much for taking our time and speaking to us. I really enjoyed
Yeah.
my
Oh, wait, don't put
conversation.
my email in the show notes. I only want people to listen to the end of this podcast to find me. Please, can I make that
Okay.
request? Yeah, I don't want my email everywhere, but I want listeners to know my email. It's
Okay.
josh@thepitch.show.
Awesome. We'll put that. All right. Thanks, Josh. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Rohit. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Life Self Mastery podcast, where we teach you how to start and grow your online business. For more information, visit Rohit's blog at www.lifeselfmastery.com.